No, it would almost consume us. A few months later, in the spring of 1994, the wallowing began. We always had our hit-by-a-truck succession plan, a short list of people who could take over if something happened to me. Now, for the first time, we looked beyond an emergency and cast a wider net to get at those with the potential to take over in 2001. Before jotting down names, Chuck Okoski, our vice president for executive development, put together a list of the stuff an ideal CEO should have. The specs were filled with skills and characteristics you'd want: integrity, values, experience, vision, leadership, edge, stature, fairness, and energy balance, courage. Chuck's list included such attributes as having an insatiable appetite for increasing knowledge and demonstrating courageous advocacy. I tossed in a couple of things I wanted, like being comfortable operating under a microscope and having the stomach to play for high stakes. The exercise wasn't very helpful. When you get down to it, Christ couldn't have filled the job we described. By wallowing with our Session C books, Bill, Chuck, and I did come up with 23 candidates. The list included the obvious people in big senior vice president jobs, and for the first time, 16 high-potential long shots in a broader consensus field, including the three people who would ultimately become the final players. The youngest was 36, the oldest was 58, obviously one of the emergency candidates. The field included CEOs of several of our businesses, as well as young vice presidents. These were the best prospects we had in 1994. We mapped out developmental plans for each of the candidates, plotting promotions for everyone until the year 2000. We wanted to give the younger ones broader, deeper, and more global exposure in several businesses. Bill and I made our first formal pitch on succession to the Management Development Committee of the Board in June 1994. We showed the directors the ideal CEO list, the names of all 23 candidates, with specific plans for the 16 high-potential long shots. From that moment on, all the key decisions in their careers were made with succession in mind. Despite our best-laid plans, looking at the results today is sobering. Only 9 of the 23 people on that first list are with GE today. One, obviously, is the new CEO. 3 are vice chairman, and 5 run big GE businesses. 11 left for various reasons, including 7 who are now CEOs of other public companies. 3 retired, including 2 as vice chairman. Over the years, we watched these guys like hawks. We kept throwing new tests in front of them. The 8 who remained contenders by June 1998 had moved through 17 separate jobs. We moved Jim McNerney from his job as president of GE Asia Pacific, where we had put him to demonstrate our commitment to globalization. Jim already had experience in manufacturing, information services, and financial services. He became CEO of our lighting business. 2 years later, we moved him to be CEO of aircraft engines. Bob Nardelli, who had worked in our appliances and lighting businesses, was at the time CEO of Transportation Systems. He became the head of Power Systems. Jeff Immelt had spent most of his career in plastics, got a taste of the tough competition in the appliance industry, and moved back to plastics. He became CEO of Medical Systems in 1997. After our first board presentation in June 1994, we began formal board reviews on succession every June and December. I also gave real-time assessments every February when I went through the incentive payouts to our top executives, and every September when we discussed stock option grants. To help the directors form judgments outside the boardroom, they played golf with the candidates every April at Augusta and got together every July for golf or tennis in Fairfield. We had an annual Christmas party with spouses. Before each event, my assistant Roseanne and I would work out the golf foursomes and the dinner seatings, making sure board members always got a chance to spend time with different candidates. In 1996, I wanted the comp committee members of the board to take a closer look, without me being around. I asked Cy Cathcart, the chairman, to take his committee to each of the businesses. Cy has been a terrific friend, a great board member, and a personal counselor. He is wise and tough, was always eager to give me a tweak when I needed one, and generous with a natta boy when he thought I deserved one. Two directors, Cy and Gigi Michelson, had been on the board when Reg named me chairman. For continuity, I wanted them and a third member, Frank Rhodes, who also was a committee member, to remain through the transition. All three had been scheduled to retire. I asked the board to waive their mandatory retirement date so the company could benefit from their experience. Gigi and Frank were on Cy's committee with Claudio Gonzalez, CEO of Kimberly-Clark's Mexico operation, and Andy Sigler, the retired chairman of Champion International. They spent a day with each business leader and his team, including dinner or a ball game at night. Nothing was staged by me. Early on, a few of the candidates called and asked, "Jack, what's the drill?" "This is your show," I replied. I wanted the board to see how each business leader handled things. Some gave elaborate presentations, others had few papers. Some brought their entire staffs, some did it with one or two associates. After each trip, Cy would drop me a note with the committee's impressions. 4 years after the first list, after retirements, departures, and people who fell out, the original 23 had been narrowed to 8 serious candidates. We were still playing around with that ideal CEO list, adding and dropping things, but it still had a Superman feel to it. Much more helpful to me was a list of 8 basic objectives Bill, Chuck, and I put together in 1998. 1. Pick the strongest leader. 2. Look for the best complementary mix of corporate executive officer skills. 3. Retain all contenders through transition and into the next administration. 4. Minimize dysfunctional competition. 5. Create opportunities for up-close and personal view of the contenders before the final decision. 6. Provide the necessary transition time given the company's breadth and complexity. 7. Anticipate backfill requirements for concurrent selection announcements. 8. Keep options open as long as possible, consistent with the 4th and 5th objectives. This was a wish list, but it was a pretty good one. We wouldn't meet all these objectives. I became convinced number 3 was unrealistic. We weren't going to retain all the candidates, and I had come to the conclusion we shouldn't. 4 and 5 turned out to be in conflict with each other. Getting an up-close view by bringing them to Fairfield would risk dysfunctional competition. The other objectives held up. The most important lesson I took from my own succession was the need to take out all the internal politics. This may be hard to believe, but that's the way it turned out. After it was over, the finalists told me they saw it the same way. Our values had become so important that if any one of the candidates played games, their colleagues would have thrown them out. Even when we settled on the final 3 by the end of 1998 and the media began cranking up the pressure, not one of them did anything to undermine the other. In fact, if anything, it was the opposite. Keeping all 3 in their field in their current jobs, Bob in Schenectady, Jim in Cincinnati, and Jeff in Milwaukee, allowed each to focus on nothing but his business, not politics, not second-guessing the business their friends once ran, and not maneuvering in a new bureaucratic layer in the organization. The downside was obvious. I wouldn't get that one-on-one personal view of each candidate Reg gained when he brought us all to Fairfield. I didn't need a close-up view. I had been hanging around with these 3 for years, but I did create opportunities for a better look without bringing them to headquarters. In 1997, for instance, I put all 3 on the GE Capital board. After every monthly meeting, I had lunch with them. I tried to take any formality out of these Fairfield luncheons. We'd fool around and I'd get to hear their opinions on the deals that GE Capital was proposing. This worked for a while, but as we grew closer to the end, it became too awkward for everyone, so we stopped doing it. I did something else. It was a little like Reg's process, but handled outside the office. I began having private dinners with each of the 11 major business CEOs in the spring of 1999. Over a meal, I asked them for their opinions about our businesses, what we ought to keep, which ones we should throw out, and who should make up the leadership team at the top. I asked them to pick 3 leaders, not wanting to force anyone into the box of picking 1 winner. These sessions were helpful for putting a team together, but didn't do much to pick a clear successor. I repeated the process again in the spring of 2000. This time, I focused more on things outside their own businesses. I wanted to know their thoughts on our current union negotiations and environmental issues. I had a candid exchange about what they thought of one another. Again, no surprises. They all liked and respected one another. I also asked a lot of questions about our processes and values, what they liked about them, and what they'd jettison. One of the most important questions I asked three of them was probably the most challenging to answer. If you weren't picked as CEO, would you leave? Two of them, one more directly than the other, made it clear they would leave. One said he wanted the job, he loved the company and the people so much that he would stay to see how it played out. I discounted that because the headhunters would have been all over him. With the enormous visibility they all got, that turned out to be a pretty good assumption. By this time, I had made up my mind that it was unrealistic to think we could keep all of them. From the start, I always saw the process as more than just naming a CEO. I also wanted to create a broader team, using the vice chairman positions to help the new guy. I didn't want disappointed candidates or those who wouldn't be able to work with my successor in these roles. I thought the perfect choices were Dennis Dammerman, then CEO of GE Capital, and Bob Wright at NBC. The two of them always came up as big players with everyone in my dinner conversations. Dennis was named a vice chairman in late 1997 and Bob in July 2000. Dennis was involved in the selection process almost from the beginning, while Bob played a role after becoming vice chairman. As the media heated up in 2000, the uncertainty mounted. At my Crotonville sessions, classes began asking how I would keep all three at GE and who would replace each of them as business CEOs. The analysts on Wall Street were asking the same questions. I've had plenty of ideas, good and bad, but I got a really good one during a weekend in June. It came in the shower. I often do some of my best thinking there. Because I was sure two of the three would leave, I decided to lose them on my terms. Instead of waiting to name their replacements after one moved up or left, I decided to put their successes in right away. Bob, Jim, and Jeff might have 5 uncomfortable months left in their jobs, but new leaders in their businesses would be well-trained and ready to go. Their organizations would know who the next boss was going to be, and that would lessen the rumors and gossip. I also thought it would reassure Wall Street. During our session C's, every business leader has to name his or her successor. It's often a rote exercise. In April 2000, with the CEO decision pending in December, I wrote all of our business leaders and asked each of them to spend at least an hour this time discussing their replacements. Those discussions fleshed out who the three candidates in particular liked and wanted. On Monday morning, I excitedly told Bill and Dennis about my idea developed over the weekend. They were enthusiastic. We could now put people in new chief operating roles who we knew were compatible with the CEOs. Since the board was up to speed on all the people, it was easy to get the directors on the phone that week and take them through this new thinking. They liked it. Now I had to explain this decision to Bob, Jeff, and Jim. I acknowledged that it might seem unfair, but I made the case that it was in the best interest of their employees and our share owners. Nonetheless, it came as a surprise to them. "Well, are you telling me I'm either up or out?" asked one. "Yeah, that's it. You threw the gauntlet down by telling me you were going to leave if it didn't work out. I'm saying, okay, here's the guy who's going to replace you. Now you train him for 6 months." "What finality," he replied. "Look, I know this is a little cruel because it seems so final, but I have to make this call." None of them thought it was the greatest thing that ever happened, but they understood it really was in the company's best interests. If the people factory ever needed validation, we certainly got it in June of 2000. We were ready with three great people as new chief operating officers. All were 43 years old. Dave Calhoun had been head of the audit staff and then went through a series of CEO jobs in Plastics Asia, transportation, lighting, and then reinsurance. He is bright, fun, quick, an avid sportsman, and a strong relationship builder. Dave was perfect to be COO under Jim McNerney at Aircraft Engines. I first met John Rice during a luncheon with young auditors in Schenectady. He had a great personality, an incisive mind, and I liked him instantly. I told him, "Get out of finance and get into operations." John did and went directly into appliance manufacturing. After a series of promotions, he eventually replaced Dave Calhoun first as CEO of GE Plastics Asia and then as CEO of GE Transportation. This experience made him a natural as COO under Bob Nardelli at Power Systems. Joe Hogan worked in plastics in many global assignments before becoming CEO of GE Fanuc. Joe is 43 and looks about 15. He probably gets carded at every bar. He might look that way, but he's a mature manager with terrific interpersonal and natural leadership skills. We had brought him into medical systems as head of e-business several months earlier to get ready for his next job as COO under Jeff Immelt. Putting these three stars into these new jobs was a game-changing event. While 300,000 employees, including me, still didn't know who their chairman was going to be, the people in three of our biggest businesses knew exactly who their new CEOs would be. Publicly, I said the changes were a natural step in our leadership succession plan. I continued to turn away reporters who wanted to talk about these moves or anything else involving succession. So did Bob, Jeff, and Jim. None of us wanted to help the media make a circus of it. If anything, though, I was naive to think I could hold off the press completely. After all, the first stories about my succession had cropped up as early as 1996. As we moved into September, 2 months before naming my successor, it seemed that all the media could focus on was the succession at GE. In the space of 3 or 4 days, stories cropped up in Business Week, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, and the Sunday Times of London. The articles not only named the frontrunners, they also handicapped and profiled them without any help from us. When the stories broke, I was at the Olympics in Australia. Reading the faxed articles in my hotel room, I was surprised at how much attention our succession was getting. I also felt terrible about it, knowing how much more pressure it was putting on the three of them. I sat at my laptop in the hotel room at 1:30 in the morning, typing emails to all three. Jeff, Jim, Bob, I'm sorry that you have to go through all of this press nonsense. I thought I could do it better than Reg by leaving everyone in the field. It turns out the press will make every succession into some sort of conflict. Thanks for being such great guys. The company's lucky that you've stayed with the process. Your great results and tremendous attitude in every way have made the process even more challenging for me as well. Thanks for truly being so special. I meant every word of it. One response was typical of those I received. The bottom line, Jack, is that we're all pretty lucky to have been part of it all. And that feeling overwhelms any discomfort with the public scrutiny. Growth, challenge, and fun have made it all unforgettable, no matter what happens to whom next. You're doing the right thing for GE, and I'm certain we all support the process. Your favorite contender. The replies were typical of the quality of the people who made it this far, and that only made it harder for me. There were times I joked that I wished one of them would do something dumb or crazy. A scandal would have made the decision easier. When I reviewed the process again with the board, I took the directors through how hard it had become for me. Sam Nunn, the former U.S. Senator from Georgia, who had been on our board since 1997, had a great response. "Jack," Sam said, "stop feeling sorry for yourself about picking one of these guys. You've made them all famous. They're going for the best job in America, and it's not clear which one of them is going to get it. That means they're all great. Putting them in this position, you've done more for their careers than ever would have happened if they remained hidden." That was some consolation for me, but I knew that it didn't make things any easier for them. As those stories popped up, all three were at a Prudential Securities investment conference in Stowe, Vermont, having breakfast together. They were the focus of everyone in the room. A few days later, I bumped into John Blystone, who had been at the same conference. John left GE in 1996 to become CEO of SPX. "You should really be proud," he told me. "Those guys joked and teased each other from the stage. They were totally supportive of each other. The shareholders sitting there saw the top of the company operating as one team. You have to feel very good about that." Ironically, John didn't know that he was among the 16 stars on our first list in 1994. Truth is, I was so proud of all three. Everyone is a little different here or there, but all of them are terrific human beings. All were running their businesses at record margins, at record market shares, and with the highest employee morale ever. Bob had been given a business in 1995 that had power turbines failing all over the field. The business's net earnings had gone down for 3 straight years. He drove the technical fix for the turbines and then got the benefit of a shortage in power capacity that caused demand to skyrocket. He put terrific operating mechanisms in place to take advantage of that surge. He made dozens of global acquisitions. He was taking the business from a base of $770 million in operating income in 1995 to $2.8 billion in 2000. Even more important, he was projecting net income growth of $1 billion every year from 1999 to 2002. There are only a few companies in the world that make $1 billion after taxes, and Bob was on track to add an incremental $1 billion annually for the next 3 years in a row. Jim was turning in great results, too. In the 3 years that he led our aircraft engine business, it contributed more profit to GE than any single unit in GE's top 20 businesses. He pushed the business's top-line growth to $10.8 billion in 2000 from $7.8 billion in 1997, while growing earnings 21% per year. He drove services to the point that they had become more than half of the business's total profits. And getting the GE90 engine, the largest and most powerful jet engine for Boeing's long-range 777 jet, was a terrific strategic accomplishment. Jeff had likewise taken our medical systems business to new levels. He came up with the concept of a global product company that will be a model for almost every business in the company, sourcing intellect, components, and finished products from every corner of the world. He made numerous acquisitions and integrated them well. He was making medical as much an information company as a hardware business. In 3 years, he led the business to record profit and revenue, growing sales from $3.9 billion in 1996 to $7.2 billion in 2000, also increasing net income 21% per year. Jeff made us a much stronger competitor in Europe and took us to number one in Asia. In addition, medical had brought out more new products using Six Sigma technology than any business in the company. It wasn't just their great performance that was making the decision so hard. I went way back with these three guys. They had been in my classes at Crotonville. Long before they became business CEOs, I had spent hours and hours with them in all kinds of reviews. I had promoted them and watched them grow, often through very tough jobs, into incredibly self-confident executives. I had first met Jeff while he was still an MBA student at the Harvard Business School in 1982. When he picked GE over Morgan Stanley, a Morgan partner tried to talk him out of it. "GE, listen, if you come to work for Morgan Stanley, you're going to be presenting to Jack Welch in the first 6 months. If you go to GE, maybe, just maybe, you'll get a glimpse of him in your 10th year." 30 days after joining the company, Jeff was sitting around a table with me and five others from our corporate marketing group. Like so many strong executives, he went through his lumps, and I was in his knickers during the worst of them. We had moved him to appliances in 1989 to broaden his experience in a tough industry. It gave him more experience a lot faster than we expected. He got right in the middle of a massive recall when a compressor failed on a new line of refrigerators. Jeff had 7,200 employees fixing 3 million compressors. I saw him up close in the monthly operating reviews we had during this crisis. Another time I was all over Jeff was when he had a really tough year at Plastics in 1994. As general manager of GE's Plastics Americas, he had agreed to a number of fixed-price contracts at Plastics and was caught between rising material costs and his commitments to our customers. He missed his net income number by $50 million. As Jeff tells the story, when he came to Boca in January 1995, he tried hard to avoid me. He was coming to dinner late and going to bed early. I finally caught up with him the last night as he was rushing off to the elevator in his room. I grabbed him by the shoulder and turned him around. "Jeff, I'm your biggest fan, but you just had the worst year in the company, just the worst year. I love you, and I know you can do better, but I'm going to take you out of it if you can't get it fixed. Look, he said, if the results aren't where they should be, you won't have to fire me because I'm going to leave on my own. Of course, he fixed it, and then just nailed every job he held after that. There are similar stories I could tell about Bob or Jim. For me, this was an emotional decision. There was a lot of blood, sweat, family, and feelings to it. I never had trouble making decisions. This one was different. At the July 2000 board meeting, we spent 3 hours with the comp committee, wrestling with the pros and cons of each candidate. It was a wide-open meeting. Throughout the session, I was fighting not to make up my mind. I wanted to keep my options open until the very end. After the morning session, we had the usual golf outing with the CEOs of our businesses. I asked the committee to come back an hour early the next morning after they had a chance to sleep on our 3-hour discussion. It wasn't until a Sunday night, October 29, 2000, that I made my recommendation. We were in Greenville, South Carolina for a board visit to a power turbine plant. This board trip had been scheduled a year in advance. It probably wasn't the smartest move I ever made. It would place more pressure on Bob Nardelli than he deserved, but I liked to show the board stuff that was hot. Thanks to Bob, nothing was hotter than power systems, and the next morning he put on a great show. After a weekend golf outing at Augusta with many of our current and former directors, a tradition that dates back at least to Reg's years, we flew to Greenville for dinner in a private room at the Poinsett Club, a beautiful old southern mansion. That Sunday evening, there was a bit of a sideshow prior to our succession decision. As it happened, 60 Minutes was to air a profile of me. Bob's team from Power Systems was there along with our board members watching any one of several television screens in a dining room. When the football game delayed 60 Minutes by nearly half an hour, I got really nervous. My interviews with Leslie Stahl had gone well, but you never know what to expect. They had over 23 hours of tape for a 15-minute profile. When you're that exposed, almost anything could happen. In fact, Leslie treated me very well. I was relieved to have it over. After the dinner, our directors were driven to the nearby Hilton Hotel. We had reserved an upstairs conference room at the Hilton for a special board meeting. To ensure privacy, GE Security was stationed outside. The only non-board member there was Bill Connedy, who had worked the process with me from day one. Bob and his team went to their rooms or home. Shortly after 10 p.m., I opened the session. We've come to a conclusion. For the next 15 minutes or so, I told the board why I thought Jeff should be the new guy. He had done great things in our medical business that would be a model for the future of GE. I felt Jeff had the perfect blend of intelligence and edge and epitomized the trait that's so important to me. He was really comfortable in his own skin. While it was obviously close, I thought he was the perfect selection. Dennis Dammerman and Bob Wright had their say. Dennis recalled how he first interviewed Jeff at the Harvard Business School in 1982. He focused on his leadership skills and customer focus. Bob commented on his runway. Then every member of the board weighed in, all in unanimous approval. At the end of the table, Frank Rhodes spoke eloquently about Jeff's capacity to learn and grow. In his mind, he said, Jeff had the intellectual bandwidth and was clearly the right choice. It was one of the best meetings I had ever been in. Everyone wanted to say something. We had all been carrying the same burden. At least two directors raised the possibility of trying to keep at least one of the two other candidates. It killed them to lose so much talent. Are you sure you don't want to try to keep one? Asked one board member. I've been there, I said. I know what it's like. Whoever becomes chairman of this company has to be filled with self-confidence and full of enthusiasm. I want him to feel bigger than life. I don't want him looking over his shoulder. I then asked Bill Connedy, who had favored keeping one of the two, to share his views. Bill said that he had initially thought the experience and skills of the other candidates was so great that we should try to keep one of them, but he had reluctantly come my way. In the end, all of us felt that the two who weren't picked deserved to run their own shows as CEOs. I ended the meeting by saying, "We don't want to make a final decision now. Take 3 weeks to think about it. Call me with whatever concerns you might have." I told the board I'd call the committee members the Wednesday before Thanksgiving to go over the decision and ask for their final endorsement. We ended our two-hour session in Greenville at midnight as my assistant Roseanne came into the conference room and cleared away all the papers. Only 6 days before the October meeting in Greenville, something happened that changed my own timetable for leaving the company. We announced our acquisition of Honeywell, and I agreed to stay in the job as CEO longer to oversee the integration instead of leaving in April as planned. The deal, our largest ever, triggered lots of media talk that it would impact our succession. Inside, however, none of us thought the deal should change anything. It didn't. And I'd ultimately leave in early September 2001, 4 months later than the original plan we had created in 1994. Over the next 3 weeks, I received phone calls from at least half a dozen of the directors who all said favorable things about the decision and the process. They also were trying to buck me up. I was thrilled with the decision, but still agonizing over telling Bob and Jim that they weren't going to get the job. On Wednesday before Thanksgiving, I called the comp committee members and got their approval to recommend to the full board on Friday the appointment of Jeff as chairman-elect. By making the decision over the Thanksgiving holiday, we'd minimize the publicity of another round of succession stories. Most people expected us to announce our choice after the regular December 15th board meeting. I called the full board after the market closed on Friday for the official vote at 5 p.m. After the board unanimously and wholeheartedly approved Jeff as chairman-elect on November 24th, I called him at 5:30 p.m. in South Carolina, where he and his family were spending the holiday. The board made a decision. It's great news for you. I'd like you to come down to Palm Beach tomorrow. Bring your family, and we'll meet you at noon for lunch. I reviewed the carefully planned logistics. Instead of using one of GE's corporate jets, we arranged a charter to pick up Jeff, his wife Andy, and their daughter Sarah in Charleston at 10:30 a.m. To assure security, Jeff was listed as James Cathcart, Cy's son, and the plane was booked in his name. Cy also sent a car from his club to pick up the emails and bring them to my home. As a final precaution, the plane flew into Stewart Airport rather than West Palm, where GE's planes normally landed. As the car pulled up, I was in the driveway, waiting to greet him and give him the great news. We went to lunch at Carmine's, an Italian restaurant in North Palm Beach. After lunch, Jane drove Jeff's wife and daughter to a condo I had in East Point. Jeff came back with me to prepare for the Monday press conference in New York. Bill Connedy, who was in Florida for the weekend, came over to help. We went over the already drafted press release announcing the appointment, tossing out NGs for new guy, and putting in Jeff's name. Dennis Dammerman, Bob Wright, and their wives flew down that night so all of us could congratulate Jeff over dinner at my house. We had a great night together, but I had a knot in my stomach because only half of my job was done, the easy half. I was dreading the next day when I had to tell Bob and Jim that they weren't getting the job. On Sunday, I waited until 2 p.m. to make my calls. I had gotten the schedules of all three candidates through the end of the year, so I knew where to reach them. Both Bob and Jim were home when I called. The board and I have made a call. I'd like to come out and review the decision and the rationale behind it. I wasn't about to tell either candidate that he was not going to be CEO over the telephone. I owed each one the opportunity to look me in the eye as I told them the news. Yet I didn't want to falsely raise their hopes. I practiced these words at least 10 times to get them right, even going through the routine with Jane before making the calls. I reached the West Palm Airport at 3 p.m. in the middle of a torrential downpour. The Thanksgiving holiday air traffic was compounded by severe thunderstorms that rocked the entire eastern half of the country. Many airports were closed, the planes grounded. When I told our pilots that we weren't going to Westchester Airport as planned, but rather to Cincinnati, they were shocked. They had to change all the flight plans and weather that made any departure doubtful. The pilot said the bad weather would keep us grounded for at least a couple of hours, so I lay on a couch thinking over what I had to say. I hated what I had to do. It was like having to pick one child over another. It seemed so unfair. They had all busted their butts for the company. They had never played unfair with me or with each other. They had given 1,000%. In this case, I had asked these three people to do this, and they all did this, and this, and then this. They had vastly exceeded our expectations. Now I had to give two of them the worst news of their careers, and I had nothing else to give them, other than encouragement that they would make great CEOs somewhere else. The afternoon grew dark early. We left Palm Beach through black skies at 5:30 p.m., and arrived at Lunken Aviation in Cincinnati around 7 p.m. The place was soaked, dreary, and dark. It was a bone-chilly night. I walked across the tarmac through a light fog toward the barely lit private airport hangar. I felt really alone, carrying only my old leather briefcase. No one was in sight. When I reached the door, Jim was already there. I greeted him, and we quickly went into a small meeting room. "Obviously," I said, "this is going to be the toughest conversation of my life." Jim's disappointment wrapped his face. I picked Jeff. "If there's anyone to be mad at me. Put my picture on the wall and throw darts at it. I can't even tell you why. It's my nose and my gut. We had three gold medal winners and only one gold medal to give." Jim joked about there being no recount. It was during the Florida presidential election mess. He couldn't have been more gracious. "I want you to know I wanted the job, but I also want to tell you I think the process was fair because you played it straight and you gave us every chance." For the next 40 minutes, we had a good conversation. We talked about his life, his dad, and his 18 years at GE. I told Jim that I had seen tremendous growth in him since our first meeting in 1982. I recalled how he'd been hired out of the consulting firm of McKinsey by one of my old Pittsfield associates, Greg Lamont. From his first job in business development in our information services division to his last, he had done great things for us, none greater than his transformation of our aircraft engine business. "Your last 2 years have been your best, and you're getting better every day. You're going to be a great CEO wherever you go." I walked back to the plane only to surprise our crew again. "We're not going to Westchester. We need to fly to Albany now." They scrambled to make changes, and we flew through heavy clouds into a deserted airport in Albany around 9 p.m. It was still wet and cold. We arrived earlier than expected because of heavy tailwinds, and Bob wasn't there. I actually felt relieved by his absence. It would be especially difficult to tell him he hadn't gotten the job. Of the three, I had known Bob the longest, meeting him as a GE plant manager in the late 1970s. His dad had worked a lifetime at GE just as Jeff's father had. When Bob quit GE to join the Case Corporation in 1988, he was one of the few executives I ever tried to persuade to stay. I couldn't talk him into staying, but he did come back 3 years later. Since then, I had watched and admired his operating performance. The numbers he was delivering were the best I had seen in my 40 years at the company and could well be the best operating performance of any business in GE history. Bob showed up on time, 10 minutes after I arrived. We sat together on a couch in the corner of a large, empty lounge, just the two of us. I told him the news, and his disappointment was visible. "What more could I have done?" he asked. "Bob, you've done more than I ever would have dreamt. You've done a great job. Everyone loves you, and you're going to be a great CEO, but I can't answer this question for you. I can't give you satisfaction on it. You did everything and more that was ever asked. I believe Jeff is the right guy for this company going forward. There's only one person to blame here. It's me." Bob and I had a long, probing discussion. I wasn't able to satisfy his need for more information. His great operating results made the decision hard for him to accept. Again, I tried to soften his disappointment. "Bob, you're going to be an all-star CEO. There's a big, lucky company out there waiting to get you." We shook hands and hugged. Back on the plane, I ordered a large vodka and ice and finally flew back to Westchester. I stared out the window that night, sipping my drink, caught in lots of conflicting emotions. I was relieved it was over. I was thrilled for Jeff and totally confident we had picked the best candidate. I felt really sad to disappoint two friends who had done so much for the company. I vowed to be their agent, to help them in any way I possibly could. We had an exciting press conference on Monday. I couldn't have been more pleased with Jeff's performance. He demonstrated all the self-confidence and qualities that I knew he had. The only obvious mistake we made, and we both made it, was not checking on each other's wardrobe. We both showed up wearing blue shirts and blue blazers. The media had some fun with that. After it was over, I spent the next few days talking to my friends Jerry Roach at Hedrick & Struggles and Tom Neff at Spencer Stewart about the jobs Bob and Jim were considering. At one point, Tom was actually lobbying me to get one of the guys to go to his client, Lucent Technologies. I told Tom I didn't think it was a good idea. Within 10 days, Jim was chosen to be CEO of 3M, and Bob was picked to be CEO of Home Depot. One of our directors, Ken Langone, had a strong hand in Bob's move because he had been an active player in the succession and couldn't wait to call Bob and recruit him to Home Depot, where Ken was a founder and large shareholder. Nothing said more about the GE values than when Jim and Bob and their wives joined Reg, Jeff, and me at our annual Christmas party at the Rainbow Room of the GE building. When I mentioned them during my remarks, our directors and executives gave them standing ovations. No one clapped harder than I did. I would really burst with pride a few weeks later in Boca. By that time, I was looking forward to Jeff's first presentation as the new chairman-elect. President-elect George W. Bush, however, had asked a number of CEOs, including me, to go to Austin to meet with him for an economic briefing. I gave a brief opening at Boca and then left our operating managers meeting for the first time in 33 years. It was an unexpected but lucky break because it gave Jeff the chance to do his own thing without me sitting in the front row. When I returned that evening, a videotape of his presentation was waiting in my hotel room. Seeing him take command of the company was exhilarating. Jeff was witty, smart, visionary, and incredibly powerful. He was the CEO. In my closing remarks at Boca, I told the crowd that I watched Jeff's opening on the TV screen in my room and felt as proud of him as a first-time father. His performance triggered one of my happiest memories, the day I walked into the lab on Plastics Avenue in Pittsfield 39 years earlier, with a box of candy under my arm to celebrate the birth of my first child, Catherine. At Boca, I was figuratively vying with Jeff's own dad, who had spent 38 years working in GE's aircraft engines business, to see whose chest could pop out the most. I was sure the new guy was the right guy. Epilogue. Almost 20 years ago, I stood behind a podium at the Pierre Hotel in New York and gave my vision to Wall Street analysts for what I wanted GE to become. As high as my expectations were on that day, I never imagined that the company and the people in it would be able to achieve so much. We took a bureaucracy and we shook it. We created a world-class organization whose excellence is accepted on every continent. I believe the GE I'm leaving is a true meritocracy. A place filled with involved and excited people with good values and high integrity. It's a company that lives for great ideas, a place where the people do get up every morning searching for a better way. The journey has been a great one. Yet what GE became in 20 years is a small snapshot of a company's lifetime. We built on the 100 years that came before us. What excites me even more is what the organization might become in the next 20 years. I know that its future will be guided by a spectacular team that will take the company to greater things. At times, the first 10 years of my journey felt like a war. We were changing ahead of the curve, and we took our lumps for it. There are no modest revolutions. There are no modest transformations of organizations, either. Contrary to reputation, I've often been too cautious. I waited too long to get rid of managers who weren't willing or able to face reality. I was hesitant with some acquisitions, slow to embrace the internet, even timid about blowing up all the rituals and traditions of what once had been a bureaucracy. Almost everything should and could have been done faster. Nonetheless, GE has become an organization that relishes change, uses its size to take more risks, and is focused outward on its customers, not itself. I've always believed that when the rate of change inside an institution becomes slower than the rate of change outside, the end is in sight. The only question is when. Learning to love change is an unnatural act in any century-old institution, but the GE I'm leaving does just that. Our passion to learn and share new ideas was facilitated by an operating system that allowed diverse businesses to grow faster and perform better than they would if they were on their own. Great people, not great strategies, are what made it all work. We spent extraordinary time recruiting, training, developing, and rewarding the best. Our reach and our success would have been limited without the best people stretching to become better. Globalization was one logical outcome of Stretch. We've searched the globe for the best products and intellect. Our new Proteus radiology system from Medical Systems is a perfect example. The system, now being made in Beijing, is a product of an intercontinental supply chain that takes advantage of the best quality and lowest cost for every one of its 719 parts. The components are made in the United States, Canada, Mexico, North Africa, Morocco, Bangalore, Korea, Taiwan, and countries in Western and Eastern Europe. The scanner's generator is built in India. Its suspension system is made in Mexico, and the tube mechanism is produced in the United States. Those parts and many other components are then shipped to Beijing for assembly. Six Sigma ties all the pieces together. Books like this are supposed to end with predictions. Predictions are difficult. When I became chairman, the conventional wisdom could be distilled in three inevitable trends. Oil was at $35 a barrel and going to $100 if you could get it. The Japanese manufacturing juggernaut was going to take over America, and inflation, at 20%, would be in double digits forever. So much for predictions. There clearly are forces, however, that will change the way many of us think about markets, organizations, and management. The capitalist genie is almost out of the bottle in China. This country will have enormous influence in the new century. Chinese entrepreneurs are open to change like never before. China's leaders are managing their society as they unleash their economy. For those of you sitting in conference rooms drawing pie charts of the competitive landscape, leave half the pie open for the Chinese. There are companies in China today you've never heard of that will emerge as competitive giants in the next decade, threatening your very existence. China is a lot more than a market. It is rapidly becoming a massive competitor. The country's increasing economic power will complicate relationships among Europe, the United States, and Japan. Trade tensions will increase. I don't know what form protectionism will take, but I do know the discussions over it will be long and heated. Hierarchy is dead. The organization of the future will be virtually layerless and increasingly boundaryless, a series of information networks in which more electrons and fewer people will manage processes. Information will become transparent. No leader will be able to hoard the facts that once made the corner office so powerful. Most of the information a manager will need to run a business will reside on a computer screen in a digital cockpit. It will contain every piece of real-time data, with automatic alerts spotlighting the trends requiring immediate attention. While information will be available as never before, it will always be human judgment that will make the organization go. One evening, just a few months before I left GE, I was in a store on Fifth Avenue in New York to buy a new sweater. When the salesman helping me went downstairs to find my size in the stockroom, the manager of the store came up to me. "Mr. Welch," he said, "can I talk to you?" He was a young African-American who said he'd seen me being interviewed by Charlie Rose on television the night before. He said he had enjoyed my comments but wanted to ask me a follow-up question. During the Rose interview, I had noted how important it was for organizations to continually remove the bottom 10% of their employees. The store manager brought me to a secluded section under a staircase where no one could hear us. He explained that he had 20 people in his sales force. "Mr. Welch," he asked, "do I really have to let two go?" "You probably do, if you want the best sales staff on Fifth Avenue." I had to laugh over the fact that I was hearing my words come back to me not from someone inside GE this time, but from the floor manager of a Fifth Avenue clothing store. I think he understood that if you want to become the best at what you do, it's hard, really hard. It takes self-confidence, courage, and a willingness to take the heat when you make the tough calls. On a lighter note, the hookup between Bob Nardelli and Ken Langone at Home Depot has sparked a lot of funny banter among all of us. Ken is a larger-than-life figure. He's big, loud, generous, opinionated, and smart, an ideal director. But I brought him on the GE board in 1999 because he knows everyone, absolutely everyone. I wanted Jeff to have in Ken what I had in Walter Wriston 20 years earlier, a cheerleader telling everyone that Jeff is going to be the best CEO in America. It almost worked. A few weeks after Bob joined Home Depot, however, I heard Ken was going around New York bragging about the job Bob was doing. I called him on it. "You caught me," he said, laughing. "From now on, it'll be Jeff, Jeff, Jeff." Only a few weeks later, Fortune reporter Patty Sellers called on another story and mentioned she had interviewed Langone for an upcoming article in Home Depot. I asked her what Ken said about Jeff. She replied that he was full of praise for Bob, but never mentioned Jeff. I had a witness now. I called Ken and gave him hell. "You SOB," I joked, "I heard that you're still selling Bob. You promised me it's Jeff, Jeff, Jeff." I know Ken justifiably has mixed emotions. As a founder of Home Depot and a director of GE, he gets to see two great CEOs. I just have to keep him honest. Before leaving GE in September 2001, I had many opportunities to say goodbye. One of the more memorable farewells was the last meeting of GE's 550 top leaders in Boca Raton in early January. After 33 years of attending these meetings, more than half my lifetime, this one would be my last. I had taken over a very good company in 1981 that a lot of people had made better. I believed my successor would take over a great company and make it much greater. That's what the chairman's job is all about. I wanted to make sure that the message got through in my closing remarks. I jotted down my thoughts on a yellow legal pad, just as I always did. It took me 2 days to develop what I wanted to say. I didn't want to be maudlin or sentimental. I wanted everyone to know that GE had to change more in the next 2 decades than it had in the past 20 years. What I told them that morning could apply to any business. The message was simple. Forget what we've achieved together. Forget about yesterday. I got this job 20 years ago, and together we changed a lot, I said. It has been a fun, wonderful journey filled with great memories and lasting friendships. For much of what we've done, forget it. Today's clippings wrap yesterday's fish. This will be a whole new ball game. Change as you have never seen it, at speeds you've never seen. What fun for those who relish it. What fear for those who don't grasp it. I ended by telling everyone to turn the organization upside down, shake it up, and go blow the roof off. The speech got a warm reaction. The ending was emotional for me and for many of my longtime friends. The custom at Boca is that on the last of the 3 nights, Joyce Hergenhahn, my former head of public relations and now president of the GE Fund, announces the afternoon's golf and tennis scores. It had been a windy and cold day on the course. Some actually quit after 4 holes because it was so cold. Joyce reported my score for the day and said, "I'm sure everyone here has a favorite Jack Welch story, but since I have the microphone, you're going to hear mine." I thought, not another farewell. 13 years ago, she said, I was in the hospital in New Haven for major surgery. The day after the operation, I received a phone call from Jack saying he was coming to visit me. Instead of being thrilled, I told him I didn't want to see him because my hair was a mess. His response was pure Jack. "I can't believe you. I'm coming to cheer you up, Joyce, not to jump into bed with you." That kind of sums up Jack. There I was, thinking I was dying, but worrying about my hair. Jack's humor, candor, and friendship very quickly brought me back to reality. The 550 people in the ballroom roared, and my face turned a little red. What she said was certainly true. I guess it was something only the chairman of a really informal company, a corner grocery store, could ever say to an employee. Jeff Immelt took over next as a bunch of waiters scrambled through the room with glasses filled with champagne. Jeff said some very nice things about me that night. He reflected on my remarks at the Pierre Hotel in 1981 when I told the analysts that my dream was to create a company where people could stretch beyond their limits. Jeff said he and everyone in the room had experienced things they'd never thought possible. I was really touched by Jeff's remarks, especially when everyone stood and applauded. Jeff fought his way through the maze of tables toward me. We hugged each other, and I sat down, hoping everyone else would, too. They wouldn't. I finally jumped on top of my chair, raised my glass, and toasted everyone in the room. Together, we've all done things we never imagined. We've all gone places we never thought we would see. We've all reached dreams we never thought possible. I came from a place just like most of you, and I got lucky thanks to all of your good work. Thanks for being so special. I love you all. It was some night. I wish my mother could have been there. Acknowledgements. At every moment of my life, I've been lucky to have people at my side whose support, encouragement, and love made all the difference in the world. They filled my journey with great fun and learning. They often made me look better than I am. Some of them, like my mother, are so obvious they are all through the text of the book, and they hardly need to be mentioned here. There are many others, however, who didn't always fit into the storyline and are barely mentioned. Dr. Jim Westwater, my thesis advisor at Illinois, was one of them. Yet if not for all of them, no one would have ever heard of this guy, Jack Welch. I've sometimes said that while I might not be the brightest bulb in the chandelier, over the years, I've always thought I was pretty good at getting most of the bulbs to light up. I worry that it's not possible to give credit to all of them. So if I have forgotten anyone who played a role in my life, please accept my apologies. Even if my words or thanks seem short, my gratitude is long and deep. I first need to thank my wife, Jane, for her patience and love. She's my best friend and confidant. Jane has been more than just understanding as I obsessed over this book. I want to thank my four terrific kids, Kathy, John, Ann, and Mark. I know it's not always easy to have Jack Welch as a dad, but they've always made it easy for me. They've given me 8 fantastic grandchildren who have greatly enriched my life and will be an even more important part of it going forward. I learned early on in my career that the key to getting a job done was having a super effective administrative assistant. I've had 4 of them. Eunice Hurley in plastics, Louise Koval in my group job, Helga Keller when I went to Fairfield and for my first 7 years as CEO, and finally, Roseanne Badowski. I wouldn't have been able to get through many of my days at GE without Roseanne. She has been an incredible supporter over the past 13 years. Roseanne's dedicated assistant, Sue Bay, has helped keep things together for the last 20 years. I've had many good teachers in life, and I've tried to include all of them in the book. GE was around for 100 years before Jack Welch had any impact. I'm obviously in debt to the people who built the businesses we inherited. I'm indebted to Fred Borch, Reg Jones's predecessor, who had the courage to make me a vice president, and his entrepreneurial strategist, Jack McKittrick. Fred and Jack were adventurers. While everything they attempted didn't work out, a lot did. They were always swinging for the fences and loved trying new things. When I think about GE and its past, it's impossible to give credit to everyone. There are a few names that often come up in my early years with GE. Their efforts would have a major impact in what would come later. Whit Ridgway promoted the globalization of our gas turbine business. Gerhard Newman was the early driver of the jet engine business. Ticker Clark saw the promise in GE Capital. They and their associates helped to set the stage for the rest of us. I want to thank everyone in Selkirk who made my first management job successful, from Billy Mack to Kevin Murray, who started out on day one and stayed over 30 years. I'll never be able to thank Ted Lovino enough. As GE's former head of human resources, Ted saw the need for major change at GE, and his backing of me during the succession race was critical. I've been fortunate to have had smart, helpful human resource partners in my day, Frank Doyle and Jack Pfeiffer preceded Bill Connedy. Frank was particularly helpful during the difficult years when many were questioning our early restructuring moves. None of them got enough ink in this book, neither did Glenn Heiner, who successfully ran our plastics business for years, or Gary Rogers, who was CEO of three major businesses, electrical distribution, appliances, and plastics. I was thrilled to see Jeff Immelt nominate Gary to the board as a vice chairman in 2001. We've had many other great executives who left a mark on GE's businesses, including Dick Stonecipher and Larry Johnston in appliances, Jack Urquhart in power systems, Jim Rogers in motors, and Carl Schlemmer in transportation. Carl convinced us to invest in locomotives when few favored the business. Transportation has become a training ground for top GE CEO talent. I've already given credit in the book to Lloyd Trotter, the CEO of our industrial business, for his terrific operational performance, but I especially want to thank Lloyd for making GE better in so many other ways. His generosity of spirit makes him a role model for every GE employee. He founded and successfully drove GE's African American Forum, which brings together the company's top management with diverse employees. Over the years, we've had many terrific people who've created deep and lasting relationships with GE customers. They have always been critical, but never more than in times of management transitions. They include, among others, Ed Bavaria and Chuck Chadwell in aircraft engines, Del Williamson in power systems, Jim Del Moro, Paul Mirabella, and Tom Dunham in medical systems, Dave Tucker in transportation, and Charlie Crew, Omer Murphy, and Herb Ramrath in plastics. I've mentioned several GE board members in the book, but many others who weren't part of the book have been an important part of the story. I'd especially like to thank Sandy Warner, who always brought a valuable global economic perspective to every meeting. Henry Henley, Charlie Dickey, Barbara Preskill, Wayne Calloway, George Lowe, Bob Mercer, and Jim Cash, and some of my more recent partners, including Andrea Young, Ann Fudge, and Shelley Lazarus. From RCA, we not only got Gene Murphy, who later became a vice chairman, we also gained Rick Miller, who successfully put together GE and RCA's TV set manufacturing businesses, and John Rittenhouse, who did the same with the aerospace and defense businesses. We also got three great directors: Thornton, Brad Bradshaw, General David Jones, former head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a great American if there ever was one, and former U.S. Attorney General William French Smith. I want to mention three people who have run our pension trust and made all GE employees' retirements more secure: Ed Malone, Dale Fry, who dramatically expanded the scope of its activities, and the current head, John Myers. An example of how creative Dale and John were in their approach to the job is their investment in the Gulf and Western building in New York on 1 Central Park West. They took over the property in the mid-1990s in an uncertain real estate market, partnered with Donald Trump, and used the magic of his name and his marketing genius to turn the building into one of the most profitable hotel condo developments in New York. In addition to Peter Drucker, one other non-GE person who helped stimulate my thinking was Ram Charan. I loved batting ideas around with Ram. When Ram and I were discussing GE values and their importance, he coined the phrase social architecture. I'm especially grateful to Bill Lane, a guy who worked with me on the annual report letters every year. Bill took them as seriously as I did. I've been very fortunate to have many special friends outside of my business associates. Two have been particularly close: Anthony Lofrisco and his wife Eleanor, and Carl Warren and his wife Donna. Along with my close business social friends, the Frescos, Bossidys, Wrights, and Puccinis, they provided many laughs and wonderful company. Everywhere I went, I had a great golf foursome that made my weekend so much fun. In my early days at the Berkshire Hills Country Club, they were Dave Dansereau, Pete Jones, and John Krieger. At the Country Club of Pittsfield, they were Sel Atherton, Ernie Sagalin, and Jim O'Brien. At Silver Spring Country Club, it was Carl Warren, Ron Weber, and Chuck Loki. Finally, at the Country Club of Fairfield, there were five of us who rotated around: O.C. Adams, Tom Graham, Bill Gray, and Tom Kreitler. I want to thank Bill Hutton and his wife Joan. At age 94, Bill still comes to the office every day at Prudential Securities. He is the ultimate gentleman. Bill and Joan had been club champions at Sankaty Head years before, yet they took Jane under their wings when she couldn't hit the ball past the tee. Bill still calls my office every time GE stock hits a new high to let me know he's still rooting for us. I want to thank Strad Sherman and Noel Tishy for writing the first book about me. Working with them helped to clarify a lot of my thinking. Noel also played a key role in the rejuvenation of Crotonville. Writing a book is like nothing I've ever done before. It was a far greater challenge than I ever imagined. Thankfully, I received plenty of help from GE people in every business. Jeff Immelt and Dennis Dammerman were particularly helpful and offered valuable critiques and insights to the book. I'd also like to thank Bob Nelson, Brackett Denniston, Bill Connedy, Beth Comstock, and Joyce Hergenhahn for editing portions of the manuscript. Pam Wickham and Katie Varner were helpful in researching important facts and figures. I'm also grateful to Andy Lack of NBC for coming up with the title of the book. Bob Woodward of the Washington Post later gave Andy's notion a boost by suggesting a title along the same lines. With two successful journalists independently coming to the same conclusion, it sounded like a good idea to me. I've already thanked Reg Jones in this book in every way I know how for his unwavering support of me, but I also want to thank him for sharing his life and his views of his succession with my collaborator John Byrne during two long interviews. No one from GE, however, put in more time or made a more valuable contribution to the book than Roseanne, my assistant. She gave up many weekends and worked late nights to greatly improve the book. She helped to untangle some of my more awkward sentences, made numerous suggestions, and caught a good number of errors along the way. Several of my boyhood friends, especially Bill Cullen and George Ryan, also helped recall details of our days in Salem. John Krieger, another old friend, was particularly helpful in recalling some of our Pittsfield days. I'd also like to thank my first wife, Carolyn, who was terrific to take time on several occasions to talk with John Byrne about our years together. Bernadine Healy, head of the Red Cross, gave me the phrase superficial congeniality that I thought perfectly described the behavior of bureaucracies. It was Mark McCormick, whose semi-annual visits over several years convinced me to write the book. Mark Ryder, my agent with McCormick's IMG, helped me pick great publishers in the United States and around the world. Finally, and most important, I'd like to thank my collaborator, John Byrne. We easily spent over 1,000 hours together, going over every sentence, word, and comma. John also interviewed more than 50 people to help jog my memory. His low blood pressure and even temperament gave the team great stability. After 15 or 16 straight hours, when we were ready to drop, he'd demonstrate his curiosity and persistence by opening up his computer again to fix a troubled phrase or thought. The Time Warner Trade publishing team made a big difference. We chose Warner as our publisher because of the passion Chairman Larry Kirschbaum and executive editor Rick Wolf immediately had for the project. We were right. Larry delivered it, even over nights and weekends. We couldn't keep him away, and he basically moved in with John and me. During one of those late-night sessions, I turned to Larry and said, "You know, every time I look at you, it seems like I just came out of the womb and I'm seeing myself." I love Larry and his passion. Rick was always into the book. We nicknamed him the Train Master because he was always bugging the three of us to meet our deadlines. Because the train was sometimes late, Harvey Jane Kowal, executive managing editor, and Bob Castillo, managing editor, had to perform miracles to get the book out on time. Again, I probably missed more than a few people who made this journey possible. I hope every one of you know how grateful I am to you.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of Jack, Straight from the Gut. Written by Jack Welch with John A. Byrne and read by Mike Barnicle. Executive Producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Arthur G. Insana. Production coordinated by Dennis Kao. Edited, mixed, and mastered by Dion Audio. Jack, Straight from the Gut, is also available in hardcover from Warner Business Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.